I think the beauty of that is that because innovation, great solution always comes from constraints, limitation.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if you don't have constraints in your time, in your budget, there's no point to talk about innovation because it'll be timeless. It's keep happening, you know, what do you mean? So you have to have some constraint, limitation. What's your design challenge, design brief? You have to clearly define. And then you could think about your functional requirement. And then that's the beauty of innovation. Otherwise you become, oh, it's pointless because times keep going. You don't need to grow. You just like stay in that stable stage.
Hi everyone, welcome to Design Drives, where we interview the most forward-thinking and innovative creators on the planet to inspire and help you to reach your full creative potential. In the episode, I chat with Chenghong Li, who is a PhD researcher at MIT and also former designer at IDEO in Japan, who is now very active in service design. Chenghong is holding multiple prestigious roles in international design organizations like IDSA or IDA. He's also a former engineer, and we actually talk a lot in the episode about the intersection of science, engineering, and design, and why you actually need constraints and friction in order to create a novel solution. Chenghong is a person I highly respect as a strategic and deep thinker on design and innovation. So I hope you enjoy the episode. All right, cool. So I'm really looking forward. I'm here with Chenghong Li. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
We finally make it. We've been talking for a while to make this happen. So I'm really looking forward. Just to give people context about you. So you are a PhD researcher right now at MIT. We're going to learn a little bit about your research there. And you're also very involved in the IDSA, Industrial Designer Society of America. And specifically their committee for the IDEA Award and everything around that. So really looking forward to talk with you about service design. That is sort of an area you're very active right now, sort of design strategy and how that connects back to science. I think this was an interesting discussion we had. So what happens if you really combine science and design and the positive impact that can happen from like intersecting these two areas. So I think it would be really cool, Chenghong, if you could give a bit of a journey overview, a little bit about you. You have been doing a lot, right? We're just joking before the start of the episode. It's like, which out of your current roles and titles should we pick? But so I think it would be great for the audience if you give a bit of context about everything you've been doing so far.
Yeah. Thanks, Sebastian. Thank you for inviting me. I'm very excited to be here. I mean, virtually, but very happy to. I love Design Drive, the energy and the vibe. And for me, I was trained as an industrial designer and electrical engineer when I was in college almost 12 years ago. It's crazy. And then after that, I'm very lucky to join Design Continuum based in Boston and Asia for a year, and then work for IDEO in Asia for around like 5 years. So a lot of like experiences and like a hardcore skill is learned from the industry. And after that, I just feel, oh, that's too much. I need to back to school to recharge, because I do believe that design is application science. So everything's applicable. It's like not just about theory, framework, also about put the ideas into practice, onto market, know the business, know the social impact. So that's why I'm very lucky to join MIT. So finish my double master in mechanical engineering and also like engineering management, the two master degrees. And now it's my first semester of PhD. Very exciting, very nervous, very exhausted at the same time. Focusing on like human behavior and service design.
Right. And yeah, I think this is interesting. I mean, like, of course, like what's interesting is that you have all of this background of the different cultures and environments you have been working in. But let's talk a little bit more about your thesis you're doing right now, your PhD research, because I think that's kind of interesting for the people to hear how you can basically take your design background and now kind of use that for a PhD research study.
Yeah, so now I'm actually like kind of like design my own PhD program, and I'm very lucky like MIT have this kind of platform mechanism to allow people to craft their own PhD program. So I'm very focused on like service innovation and human behavior, and my fundings mainly come from MIT Age Lab and MIT Ideation Lab. So we did a lot of like research about aging, about senior people. So my topics focus on financial planning services for aging population. So when we think about financial planning, we probably think about money. Mm-hmm. And it's very intuitive to think of money, finance, but actually financial planning is more than that. It's like you have to think about how to improve people's quality of lives. And how do you think about invest our next generation? And how do you make the money, the finance more sustainable and more like, as a system level to look at this? And I'm trying to understand, okay, want to look at this traditional financial industry area and how to use design to drive the conversation, to kind of think about every single touch point, service touch point, to make sure things benefit not just for financial advisor, service provider, but also for service recipient, right? Like users, like senior people. So it's like very complex, but I'm very interesting, like look at this through the lens of service and system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the interesting thing is the journey doesn't start, like age lab sounds like, you know, it's kind of focusing on when you're old, but actually if you think about financial health, let's put it that way, it starts way earlier, right? So it's kind of like your user journey, your service design is like the whole life. Like,
yes,
80 years of user journey, right? The longest user journey ever, right?
Exactly. It's like people think about retirement. It's not about when you retire or you're going to retire, you think about your financial status. You have to pre-plan ahead. Exactly. So one of the challenges is like, how do you put this kind of concept or education to younger generation? Because if, for example, myself, like my parents, my family didn't give me a lot of chance to think about my financial status because they sponsored me, they helped me.
Right.
But I'm actually thinking about, wow, this is a serious issue, right? When you get old, when you retire, who's going to support you? And how do you make the money more sustainable? And that's the thing I'm interested in and very curious to learn more.
What are the key challenges you see in that regard? What are some of the key challenges when it comes to designing that experience?
Yeah, so I did a couple like expert interview, and one of the stories I want to share is like I interviewed one service designer in Philips. Mm-hmm. Philips, and then she's like in her middle of career. She's a senior service designer at Philips. Mm-hmm. And she told me like, oh yeah, my dad has with a good relationship with his financial advisor for 30 years. So they're like a buddy. They're good friends. They know each other. They trust each other. Yeah. His financial advisor know every single his fortune or money, how to invest. But versus her, she told me like, oh, financially we have separate bank account with her husband. At the same time, she has no idea where to find a financial advisor for herself, because there's a threshold, right? You have to above some amount of money to get a financial advisor. She couldn't find that. At the same time, she also don't want to chat with the robot, with AI.
Yeah.
A lot of like people online, oh, do the calculation for me. These are the money. But she feel like the computer, the technology didn't understand her needs. So that's why she kind of a bit lost. And then she self-taught herself about, okay, in that case, what are the resources she could get? How does she plan her fortune, her investment in the future? And I think that's really like a biggest pain point, because I'm thinking about myself, okay, as an international student in the US, how can I going to plan this, right? Who's going to help me? I didn't have any exposure when I was in school. So these are the biggest pain point and learning I have.
Right. So when you're thinking about the actual sort of like service design journey, right? So you think like some of the biggest challenges are in that early beginning phase, right? Like creating awareness for people and actually motivating them to deal with the topic and reduce stigmatization. Is that right?
Yeah, like people know like, oh, they want to start this as early as possible. But I think the biggest challenge is like they don't know who should ask for help. Or how to ask for help, right? So they start to look at the online forum, look at for people. Like, for example, when I interview with one leadership team at Capital One, so she's head of design or head of digital, I've forgotten. So it's more like, oh, she told me like when I think about looking for a financial advisor or have that kind of mindset is when she's going to do some critical purchasing in her life. For example, purchasing the car, purchasing the house. And you know how she find the financial advisor is through her connection.
Right.
Oh, I work with Tony. Tony is a great advisor. Go for him. So there's no like a proper, there's no like a standard way. Everyone's very different. So I'm just thinking about, for the service design's perspective, how can we design that invisible navigation system for people to know how to ask for help?
Right. And sort of navigating the journey, right?
Yeah, navigating the journey and kind of reduce the friction.
Yeah, it's really like it's a lifelong journey, and it's about education as well, right? It's not just about getting the help, but also learning about it. It's the same, you know, with taxes, for example, right? I mean, like you can get a good tax advisor, and that helps. But if you know yourself about taxes, for example, it's very helpful as well, because you understand like better how to make like decisions, right? And like these are some of the things that, you know, like I think an advisor is important, but at the same time, it's also the education that you have yourself, right? To act autonomously and independent also, right?
Yeah.
And I think what's kind of interesting, I mean, something you could maybe elaborate on is like, well, the problem you're trying to solve is very complex, right? I mean, you're a designer by background, right? How you think, and I know you're very involved also. I mean, like, you know, you have a sort of mechanical engineering background, like you said, or an engineering background. How does that connect to that research? How do you see the role of design solving these complex problems that you are having there? And is that maybe a question you sometimes get asked? Maybe.
Yeah, I think, for example, like, MIT is famous for engineering, science, right? And then maybe arts. And then for design, I think MIT has their own definition on design. It's very different, very context driven. How do you give like temperature for technology, right? And then I think we talk a lot about like, it's always become like cliche, like human-centered design. For sure, everything we design is for human, right? The human-centered, people-centered. But what I mean by that is like, we also talk a lot about empathy. And I think the difference between designers and engineers is like, we all have our hardcore skill, but it's like the mindset, also the perspective. Can you really think in shoes of other people? Can you really like understand the user needs? Can you really listen? One of the example is like, I want to share, I always share that in the class. It's like the first class I took at MIT is called Fundamental of System Engineering class. Mm-hmm. And then it's about like 25 students, I guess. And the first question asked by professor is like, he asking, okay, this is the room, this is the moon rover. It's a vehicle on the moon, right? And then he showed us the photos on the Google slides. And he asking, okay, so tell me, what are the things missing in these pictures, right? And I raised my hand. It's my first class. I'm very engaged in class, okay? I told him like, I think it's missing. It's honest feedback. And then suddenly, by the way, the all the classmates, the cohort, they are from NASA, from military, from, you know, like the soldier background. So
right.
I raised my hand and say, oh, professor, I think the moon rover missing. It's honest feedback. And he paused and the whole air like a freeze, right? And he said, oh my God, you are so soft. You're so soft, because the answer he expected to have is like, the moon rover missed like a communication system, motion system. So you can see like different ways of thinking. What I think about that, because you have to think from user perspective, you have to provide people feedback, what happened on the moon rover and how to receive feedback. And I feel the way to deal with all these complex systematic, complicated challenges is definitely through people. And people is like, we know the pain point, we can address the pain point. At the same time, we could have a better picture about what's going on. What's the real problem we're going to solve?
Right. And it's kind of interesting because, of course, like you said, like it's a skill set, but it's also like the way of thinking. And it's kind of like a funny comment there from the professor, because I think you mentioned before, and also you're one of the few designers there, right? Or
yeah,
it's mostly engineers, right? How does that How does that environment of science engineer kind of maybe influences your design approach, and how could that environment benefit or lead to better or different outcomes for designers in general?
It's a great question. I think what I learned, because my background is always design with engineering, right? My bachelor degree is like industrial design with electrical engineering. My master's like business with mechanical engineering. So I think the power of this is like, yeah, we think about design, but design without business is art,
right?
One thing, right? And then design without engineer is like, you cannot scale. How do you scale the impact? For example, we're going to build like a satellite, right? It's a ton, billions of dollars of like a prototype. How do you build that if you don't have like systematic way to think about the problems? So I think the beauty of design engineering is like, it has to be connected. It has to be integrated, because when we talk about human-centered design, we value people's perspective. At the same time, we have to think about how do we amplify the result, amplify the solution in a way that can apply to different situations. So I think that's always the beautiful tension between art, design, and engineer. And I feel, for me, it feels great to you have like a hybrid role to understand, oh, here's the way we do this, but we could think outside the box and also get the feedback and to refine, redesign the box itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can think about it as a dialogue, right? I mean, one of the early episodes of Design Rise was with a professor, Nancy Diaz from London, and she's running a program called Biodesign. And kind of interesting learning that she has, because she basically takes biologists and basically brings in designers and brings them all into one room in a master program. And I think it's the only biodesign program, I think, in the world. And what's kind of interesting is that, you know, if you start to bring these two perspectives together, like basically you need the science to empower the innovation, right? But then, like, if it doesn't turn into something that people can use and into an application, then like it's not usable science, right? I mean, like, then it's just the science for the sake of science. But like, you can develop materials and all of this in a feedback loop, right? With maybe the designer side that thinks more about the application phase and thinks more about the packaging, thinks more about like what you can do with it and how that maybe empowers new applications, prototypes, and products and solutions. And if you have that feedback loop, again, like towards the science, you can steer the science in a way that you could maybe call like human-centered, right? Because, or application-centered, or usefulness maybe also, right? So I think it's kind of like an interesting dialogue. It's kind of the missing piece, I think, for science sometimes. And doesn't need to necessarily be like a designer, but like just someone that looks more on from the application side, right? And very often that sort of falls into the category of maybe designer, right? But it can be any kind of designer, like a fashion designer or furniture designer or an architect even, right? And but the other, on the other side, design also needs it to come up with novel and new solutions, right? And actually to make something more sustainable, right? How do you make something more sustainable, for example, as a designer without the help of science, right? It's kind of hand in hand, like it works hand in hand. And I think like it's really a catalyzer for real impact, I think, if you bring these two sides together.
Yeah, it's like, I think you mentioned a great point. Like, we most people in stereotype look at engineer as a problem solver, right? But I think design and engineer together, we call it like creative problem solver.
Right.
We still solve problem, but in more creative way.
Right.
And I feel like if you look at the methodology, say, for example, design thinking process, right? Diverge, converge, inspiration, ideation, implementation, three stages. And you think about, look at that diagram. And if you look at the system engineering design process, that a lot of similarities. Mm-hmm. So when I do my master thesis, it's like focused on like, I call like a human-centered system design. It's like we have human-centeredness in the process, but at the same time, we also care about the application implementation stage. Like you have the insight, but how do you amplify it? That's the key. Because when I was in IDEO, like, you know, typical in the past before COVID, the typical like the scope of project is about 3 months.
Right.
And I'm thinking about, okay, if the 3 months you learn from the new topic and let designer to immerse themselves in the project and then start come up with solution, it could be like very high level design principle or conceptual design. But what happened? What's the next, right? And think about if we do this type of project multiple times, what we learn from this. And that's the time we need to think about this in more like systematic lens to look at this project. How can you scale? How do you find the right component? And how do you integrate it with the perspective from engineering perspective to really make this more like a stronger, more sustainable? Like you said, we need to look at this at the system level to look at this. So it's more like sustainable way, eco-friendly way.
Yeah, because you can actually also implement these things, right? Like later, yeah, you can actually make these things.
Yes.
I mean, it's like everything, right? It's like the role of a product manager, right? I mean, like you have to, like a product manager always, like the, you have like the screaming designers at one area, the screaming engineers, and then the screaming business people. And like as a product manager, you need to make them all happy and like find a solution that works for all of these parties. It is feasible, viable, and desirable, right?
Yeah.
And I think the conversation I read very often with people in that regard is that, well, if you don't have friction, and like I think you could argue that these two types of thinking that you say, like the engineering thinking and the designer thinking, kind of like thinking maybe different, but in that automatically creates tension because they have a point of contract that doesn't really work, maybe, right, in terms of like how they would approach, decide for the next steps, prioritize, communicate. But in that friction, there is the innovation, right? Because if you don't have friction in any process, you may not come up with any novel solution, right? If it just goes smooth and you never have friction at some point, you haven't been pushing it hard enough, it's not an innovation that's going to come out of that, basically, right? Because like innovation by default is a new type of, you prioritize differently, right? You come up with different conclusions and prioritize your solutions differently than maybe someone else has been doing in the past, right? And that requires sort of new ways of thinking and basically maybe the usage of, you know, removal of biases, for example. Or there's a great book from Mario von Meulen, who I also interviewed on the podcast, on counterintuitive thinking, right? That innovation very often is counterintuitive, right? And you may need someone to spark you for that counterintuitive thinking, or there are great methods for that as well, right? Yeah, I think that's kind of interesting about like that intersection of design engineering. It's a relationship that is really where a lot of tension happens, but in that tension there is the innovation. You could see this with a lot of the Apple products, right? I mean, they're coming up with that extra mile very often, where they say like they have been doing this crazy extra mile on the engineering to come up with this with something that's way more simple, right? Where like they have been pushing like each other, right? The design and the engineering really to make something better. You don't get that by, and I mean, look, hardware designers, they notice very well if they have, for example, let's say, develop a new solution and you're just integrating supplier parts, right? I mean, like you kind of like just like package around this, right? It's like it's going to be hard to come up with something innovative. I think the best way would be if you can work directly with the supplier, right, on a new solution. Or that's oftentimes why the suppliers are actually more innovative than the actual brands, because the brands, they're often like the integrated supplier things. The actual innovation very often happens at the supplier side, right? Because they have the engineers and designers sitting together and then trying to develop something that can be used for a lot of different brands and solutions, right? That's also overlooked because the credit very often goes to the brand, right? But this is oftentimes the supplier side. They come up with the innovation in the first place, right? And, you know, if you're working at the brand, sometimes, depending on what your resources are, sometimes you're just given a lot of constraints and have to work around it. But, you know, that innovation that happens on that early phase between like design and engineering. I don't know if that kind of resonates with your learnings. You have so many experiences also working at IDEO and MIT on all of these different projects.
No, this is great. You mentioned a great point. I do have that in like my personal experiences, like when I work with like a prototyping company or manufacturing company, every time I bring my concept to them, right? Hey, I want to make this and then prototyping, help me. And then they always challenge the solution. no, it doesn't work because we could make it, we could optimize it. And I feel, oh, wow, I never thought about that. Because that, I think the beauty of that is that because innovation, great solution always comes from constraints, limitation.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if you don't have constraints in your time, in your budget, there's no point to talk about innovation because it'll be timeless. It's keep happening, you know, what do you mean? So you have to have some constraint, limitation. What's your design challenge, design brief? Have to clearly define. And then you could think about your functional requirement. And then that's the beauty of innovation. Otherwise you become, oh, it's pointless because times keep going. You don't need to grow. You don't, you just like stay in that stable stage. Yeah.
No, this is very true. I mean, like in the working with the constraint and the tension, this is where the innovation happens, right? Like, it's again like this pushback from engineering, right? If you get that pushback, oh, it's not possible, you could just stop there and say, like, okay, I'm just gonna do it X, Y, Z. Or you say like, no, let's really think about like why is it not working, right? And let's sit together, let's understand the root cause of why it's not working. And there's maybe like something like a decision you can make deep, way deeper, and maybe an assumption you made about the whole solution that you can challenge, right? You can say like, actually, we don't need 4 wheels, right? For example, right? You may come across basically something that is so fundamental, right? If you're only on the top level, right? You say like, design something, no, it's not happening. Okay, but you're just gonna make it kind of work with the constraint, but you don't challenge them. You're not going to do innovation. Like innovation happens by like kind of trying to drill deep, right? You cannot do this alone also. You need the engineer, the scientist to do this because you don't know how to solve it otherwise, right? I mean, even in software product, I've been on that multiple times, yeah. You know, also at, you know, BMW, when we tried to come up with a different solution on something, you really tried to work it out with the engineer. What, why is it not working? What could we do, right? And there you come up with the crazy ideas and the creative ideas. And you can also spark the engineer to come up with the idea as well. I think that's what I sometimes learned as well. You say like, okay, it's not possible. You're trying to challenge it. But then actually, as you challenge it, you kind of spark, you know, the engineer to come up with a complete different solution, right? You know, that's very often the case. You know, it's very often that, from my experience, it's then often the engineer or the scientist who comes up with that in new approach to us. But your job as a designer is to kind of challenge that and just work with them on like maybe finding it. But it's often them who because they know the material better, right?
Yeah. I think one of the examples based on your point is like, now most people use Figma, right? Interface design, Figma. But I'm asking one faculty, and then she taught Figma. She taught interaction design class. And she also admitted to me like, yes, I teach Figma, but I don't know coding. I don't know the backup house. And what I understand, what I analysis the story is like, I think also applied to myself. It's like most of the time as designer, we could draw the big picture. Great vision, great ideas, but without engineering, without technical person, without the science to support this, it's just a dream.
Right.
It's just a dream. It's just a great illusion, but you need to make it happen. Like go to market, feasibility, viability is important at the same time. Yeah, I feel like, wow, that's something is really reflect to my situation as well sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I would like to say that there is also value in the dream. Right, there's value in the dream as well, because that's something that, you know, designer can do. I mean, like, you know, that's like, you know, like everyone has its different skill sets, but like one of the things that designers can contribute is like they can make people dream, right? And like engineers, they're just like, we don't know how to do it, right? But it kind of like, if you, depending on how you do it, right, you can bring together people on around a vision. Like the other thing to add on that, of course, like something I also have been seeing, like being purely tech driven, like it's also not good, right? I mean, like you need to dream to counter to for that attention, right? And like you have the designer kind of mocking something up that is probably not possible, but you know, and that's okay, right? Because that again shows like, okay, what are maybe like maybe customer expectations on that? What, like how it could all work super smooth without all of that technical thinking, right? And you're going, you bring it together at some point, right? But it's a push and pull, right? If it just comes from one side, it's also not good. You need that friction. You also need the designers to just also ideate for themselves, you know? And then at some point you need to again bring it together. But
yeah.
Even at Apple, I mean, like I've been talking to people who have been working there and or work there, and you know, and I think, you know, a lot of credit always goes to the design, right? I mean, like, you know, like people say like, wow, they have so amazing designers, and they really have amazing designers. But at the same time, like most of the innovation that people talk about is actually engineering, right? I mean, like the engineers have been doing the extra mile to kind of make that happen. I mean, it's probably 80-90% like engineering success and engineering magic. And then of course people say like, it's such a nice design, right? But like it's empowered by engineering, right? The design often gets the credit, or people that say like, it's a great design, but it's very often that the engineers were the people who are actually make it happen, you know? So.
Yeah, agree. Like, I think it reminds me, think about when I participate in one class at MIT, it's like, we go two string in only design, only engineering. It's like, it's not feels right. And I feel like one class is like, oh, we give a lot of technology. And then if you don't do the user research, if you don't do the field study, you just innovation for the sake of technology.
Right.
And you come up with multiple media arts, but not really something as design. And I think that's what you say, like go too extreme, too side, that'll be also didn't feel right for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the balance.
It's a balance.
Balance that is important. Yes. I think what's also interesting, you're a lot also working in regards to sustainability, right? I think that's what we've been talking to. And I don't know if there's something you from your side to share, maybe, or learnings when it comes to that, specifically at MIT, you were kind of involved in sustainability as well.
Yeah. So I worked with MIT Office of Sustainability for a year, and I'm very lucky to work with the leaders, the director of the office. And then we kind of envision what's the future safe and sustainable lab at MIT. So the lab including makerspace, right? And then it's a very big topic because MIT probably have around like, I'm not sure, but like 200 different labs. And also 50 makerspace. The number I'm not sure, but the idea is like there's so many makerspace, so many labs, and how do we design a system or like a principle to help them, to guiding them to think about safe and sustainable in the future, like not just about material flow, also about people's behavior, right? One of the simple, very simple and very life relevant example is every time we have like coffee cup, finish the coffee, right? Should we put it in the recycle or non-recycle? It depends, right? And most people throw it in the recycle, but you can because it already gets stained, you know, gets stained by coffee. So you have to throw in non-recycled trash bin. But even just the small, tiny movement or people's behavior, how do you change the trash bin? How do you change, like, people make decisions naturally? Because people are lazy. I'm lazy. So naturally you design the thing like how do you easily navigate the wayfinding in the lab in the makerspace to help people to make the right decision. And so because of that kind of project challenge, we visit like 7 different labs and makerspace to understand what are the material flow and what are the people's like ritual in the lab and how do they design the makerspace in a way that people know easy to navigate, self-serve. And not just for safety reason, also for sustainability reason. Can we recycle the material? Can we, how do we recycle material? How do we know which materials should be trashed? Because we knew that a lot of students say, not just for a school of architecture, also from other departments, we do a lot of making, prototyping, right? A lot of material it could be poison, could be toxin into our environment. And how do we know that? Is it like we design a label? Or is it like we have great recycling team to help us do that? And these are things we did for a year. Yeah. And I think the biggest difficult thing is like change people's behavior.
Right. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think like a key aspect to that is education, right? I mean, contextual education, you could say, right? In terms of like behavior. I mean, like, you know, very often people don't know, because like you said, like people are lazy, you know, like they have a lot of things like already to take care of and like to solve in their mind. And it's just like one more dimension. And so I think like education, I mean, is also very critical, right? That, you know, that I don't know, what is your learning about that? Is it about education and awareness? It's probably also about interaction design, right? I mean, I guess like what is interesting also about your use case is that you kind of like picking like a, like you don't go too broad, like for like your space of solving, because I don't know if you did prototyping, but if you're in a lab, you can end prototype like, and then basically see if people are behaving different. Let's say you redesign the bin, for example, or redesign the cups, in a way that, you know, guide the user there, right?
Yeah, you're right. Like we did some prototype, we did some experiment, and then some lab is like super cool. They have their own lab culture. Lab ritual. Oh, they have people on duty every week, and they have set like a plan for recycling. For example, every time you order from Amazon, right, a lot of boxes, a lot of like packaging, and for them, when they order a lot of like experiment materials, a lot of packaging waste, and how do they recycle it? How do they compress it? And these are things, it's solvable, because like you said, how do we create that awareness and education, and how do we sell the right culture? And these, I think, heavily depends on the leaders of the makerspace or lab. At the same time, from the school, from the institutional level, how do we sell like a right system or right regulation to encourage people to do the right thing? And that's also another thing that we observe and want to figure out more through this project.
Before this podcast, we had a lot of discussion about like how designers can figure out like how to ask the right questions or pick the right problems to solve, right? I kind of like what you're saying there, that sounds like that there's sort of there's a lot of ground for that, right? Because is it like asking the question like, how can we make people like throw this thing not in the wrong bin? Or is it maybe the question more about like maybe already earlier in the user journey, right? So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that specifically. How can designers ask the right questions and solve the right problems?
Yeah, this is a great question, because I think for me, like we all know that every time we do the research or different types of project, what's the project brief? Mm-hmm. And that also backs to our early conversation. Do we know the limitation? Do we know the constraints, right? Because that kind of reframe the how might we question the challenge we have. Right. And then in the context of sustainability, like for example, redesign the lab or makerspace to become more safe and sustainable, it's super broad. And then my approach is like, yes, we could stay at high level, because in this sustainability office, like we have so many key stakeholders. You know, we have people from environmental health, we have people from D-Lab, different space, different lab, they all to be part of this journey. So we stay high level, but for designers, my job is like, make it tangible, make it easy to understand, make they like, people can reflective. So I did like a 5 minutes documentary, interview people, capture their quotes, and reassemble us like a documentary film to share back to the leadership team. So they feel, oh, wow, this is what you mean by redesign a safe and sustainable lab. This is what you, how do you envision the future of MIT lab? And that's really powerful, because one of the key things we mentioned a lot is like bring tangibility, make it easy to understand, and let people to have time, ideas to build on the top of your ideas.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the superpowers of, you know, that designers can add to any process of innovations, that designers are incredibly fast to visualize, make things tangible, document things, and take a whole lot of information, 2-hour abstract discussions of different stakeholders, a lot of research, a line of thinking that is coming out of a group, and put this into something tangible quicker than most people can, because they can visualize things. This can be the doodle on the board, this can be a quick presentation, this can be a video, this can be a prototype, this can be a product design. And then it's not about being like depending on what you kind of focusing on, that it's not about being completely right with and with everything, but just accelerating also, right? So let's say you'd say like you create the first prototype out of what you were hearing so far, right? Or you maybe were in a group of and people were discussing about something and they had this idea of what it could be, and you know, but maybe in the next meeting you already have a tangible form of that. And then people can say like, well, you know, it's not exactly what we meant, but you know, it's kind of going to that direction. And maybe some for someone else, that's exactly what I meant, right? So like you start to have a new ground, right? You draw an image that people can start to discuss again, right? So people can say like, oh, yeah, like a little bit like this and so, okay, next evolution. That way you can accelerate discussion. It's way faster than a thread of emails. You can go for yes, right? Like it's just text. Yeah. Right? We as designers, we can take these different mediums, text, voice, video, and we can put it into a form, you know, into a new form, yeah. A form that creates a playground, like creates a space for discussion, further decision-making, evaluation, feedback, yeah, and just a jump board to the next version of it, right? I mean, and this is, I think, like a core power of design, and I think it's basically like you said, like a digital product is never done because you constantly keep developing. You could apply the same thinking even earlier as like, you know, like also an idea is never done, right? Like what is the first state of an idea or like a first state of a discussion towards like a product brief or, you know, something.
Yeah, no, I think I will use one example is like, think about design drive. Design drive is the best example, right? You create a playground. So we make it tangible through like video, through audio, and through website. So people could be part of this and then also express their thoughts. I think that's really like design is a superpower. One of the superpowers, like make things tangible, accessible, and also like easy to understand through all this like different format. Yeah. And facilitate the conversation. Yeah.
Right. I'm glad designer has come to your mind in terms of case studies. Yeah. But I think this is a good point to end the episode. I think I would love to continue talking with you. I think there was so much great insights, and I'm looking forward to continue the discussion offline with you. And But I would just say also here in the episode, really thank you for your perspectives, and really happy about I think the insights you have been sharing.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I'm very excited. I feel it would be great. We have more people and work this on together, and really view design as a way to think the problem, to execute the problem. Yeah.
Thank you. All right, that was the episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to give it a thumbs up and let me know in the comments about your thoughts and biggest learnings from the episode. I'm always super curious about that. You can also tag me in a post about your biggest takeaway and share your insights with others to pass on your learnings. If the episode provided you a lot of value, make sure to follow, subscribe, and share it with friends and colleagues so they also have the chance to learn and grow. Until next time, cheers.